Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Season 3, Episode 23, The Sovereign of the Seas. Welcome back to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. Before we begin today, there have been some changes to the House of Lords. Philip Milich is now Earl of Canterbury, and Amir Latifi has been elevated to the Dukedom of Pembroke. All patrons get their own premium RSS feed that lets them listen to the podcast without ads. The Earl of Canterbury and the Duke of Pembroke can both listen to the bonus content, including the recently released episode of The History of the Mughals. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to find out more. Last week, we covered how diplomatic efforts between the Commonwealth of England and the United Provinces of the Netherlands had failed, as tensions rose and shots were fired in anger. Today, we'll first look at how the two countries had very different naval strategies, and then we'll cover the first few months of the Anglo-Dutch War, as two titans of naval history, Admiral Martin Tromp and Admiral Robert Blake, square off. First, let's talk about how the Dutch fleet and the English fleet were different, and why that was. The Dutch Navy, as we touched on last time, was made up of several different admiralties, which could come together in times of war, but which were riven by political, provincial, and personal rivalries. For the sake of convenience, though, I'm going to refer to the Dutch Navy, rather than the Dutch Navies, and De Witt can go ahead and haunt me for my centralising language if he wants. Dutch naval strategy can be summarised as disable and capture or burn. This played to Dutch strengths in numbers, speed and manpower, and avoided their weaknesses in firepower. Their ships were smaller, faster and more manoeuvrable than their English opponents, meaning they could close to melee as quickly as possible. The ships were also usually packed with marines and sharpshooters, who could board and disable English warships. Dutch ships had limited cannon, usually smaller pieces which could do little against the thick hulls of warships, but which worked perfectly well against a target's masts, sails, rigging, and crew. In an ideal engagement, the Dutch ships would close the distance to a target ship while their cannons disabled it by destroying their masts, leaving the English ship immobilised. Once demasted, the Dutch ship or ships would come alongside the stricken vessel, and marines and marksmen would kill or capture the English crew. The marines would clear the ship, suppressing any resistance, and then either take the ship as a prize or scuttle it, depending on the situation. It was a very effective strategy, and as Churchill and Hainsworth say, quote, "It represented a formidable threat to any opponent who possessed a fleet built on the same principles for the same tactics." The problem was that the English Navy was not built on those principles. End quote. English naval thought had, for decades, focused on large, heavy ships armed with powerful cannons. During the English Civil Wars, Parliament took the existing Royal Navy and gradually built it up. By the time of the regicide, the navy was already pretty formidable. At the very top of the hierarchy were the first rates, the great ships, the Sovereign of the Seas and the Resolution. The Sovereign was 1,200 tons and armed with 110 guns. This was one of the fruits of Charles I's ship money. It was built to match its name because it really did rule the waves. The Resolution was slightly smaller, at a mere 1,187 tons and carried 70 guns. Below the first rates were 12 warships between 700 and 900 tons and carrying at least 40 guns. Then there were 8 smaller ships carrying between 30 and 40 guns, and finally were 7 frigates, really 3rd, 4th or 5th rates by later classification, which were between 450 and 650 tons and carried 32 to 46 guns. After the regicide and the new modelling of the navy, the result of the Navy Commission's building and purchasing agenda was 41 new ships. These included the Speaker, with 50 to 56 guns and weighing 778 tons, the Fairfax, 52 guns, 789 tons, the Worcester, 48 guns, the Antelope, 56 guns, and the President, with 38 guns. During the war with the Dutch, the state's navy would expand even more from state-commissioned warships and captured prizes, with another 111 ships joining the fleet between 1652 and 1654. 11 of these were third rates between 48 and 52 guns, and 15 were fourth rates with 38 to 48 guns. Now that is one big list of ship names, tonnages, and numbers of guns. And don't worry, none of it will be on the test. The reason I bring this all up is that very few Dutch ships were heavier than 450 tons or carried more than 40 guns. And as you might have picked up from that list, this means that the English fleet outgunned and outweighed nearly every ship that the Dutch could bring to a fight. Admiral Tromp's flagship, the Brederode, was the largest and most well-armed vessel flying the Dutch flag. But it was originally a merchant ship, not a purpose-built warship, and there were 14 ships of the state's navy that matched or outclassed it. Now we talk about the guns themselves. Standardisation will not be a thing until after the Restoration, and ships carried different numbers and sizes of cannon at different times. But as a rule, the largest ships in the state's navy, like the Sovereign of the Seas, carried artillery pieces that were normally only seen on land. As in, they fired cannonballs large enough and hard enough to damage stone walls. These were ship killers. The Dutch ships could not match that kind of firepower. Not only could they bring fewer guns, but their cannons were smaller calibre, and it wasn't simple to just bring in bigger guns. For one thing, these large calibres weren't manufactured in the Netherlands, not at any great number, and they'd have to be imported at great expense. For another, Dutch ships weren't designed to carry such large pieces. Dutch ships were designed to be light and to sit high in the water. This made them faster and better able to navigate the shallow waters of Dutch harbours. Put a siege gun on them, and if they didn't capsize, they'd sit too low in the water, slowing them down or running them aground, and that was before you tried to fire them. The deck needed to be reinforced to take their weight, and the structure of the ships themselves had to be designed to withstand the vibration of a shot. This simply wasn't the strategy of the Dutch Navy. In one major respect, the Dutch Navy held an advantage over the English. The Netherlands could call on far more trained sailors than the Commonwealth could. But that was not an insurmountable challenge for the state's navy to meet. Yes, some of their ships never had enough crew to properly man the guns. Gunners often had to fire one broadside and then run to the other side of the ship to fire the second, and then try and reload as their ship tacked off out of immediate danger. But though the Netherlands had a long-standing maritime culture, the Commonwealth was a very quick study. For starters, the Commonwealth was fully prepared to impress sailors and force army soldiers to serve in the navy. Veterans of combat, these soldiers turned sailors, were disciplined and experienced. That helped make up for the difference in crew numbers. But the other factor was morale. Even those conscripted into the state's navy found the conditions to be fairly decent. The sick and the wounded were taken care of, and pensions were promised to the families of those killed in service. Pay was mostly regular, and the food was, well, it was disgusting by modern standards, but at least it was there. It was a far cry from the earlier years of the Royal Navy. And of course, the crews knew that their commanders knew their stuff. Robert Blake was at their head, and he was famous for his achievements. The other generals at sea were likewise well known for both their talent as commanders, but also their care for the men under their command. And they all got on. There was very little rivalry compared to the Dutch Navy. This all helps explain the very low rate of desertion that the state's navy enjoyed. The state's navy may have been outnumbered by the Dutch, but numbers weren't everything. And even if they had been, the Commonwealth was ready to build as many warships as they needed.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Admiral Robert Blake had received his orders. The Council of State had decided that the Achilles heel of the United Provinces was their trade. To this end, Blake was ordered to, quote, take and seize up the Dutch East India fleet homeward bound and secure the same, or as many as shall be taken. He was also told to attack and disperse the Dutch fishing fleet, which prowled off the English and Scottish coasts, and also to locate and capture the Baltic trading fleet too. It was high time to attack that mountain of gold which Grand Pensioner Poir had predicted. But that mountain had been warned, if you can warn a mountain. The fleet of the VOC, the Dutch East India Company, had been advised to avoid sailing through the English Channel. The previous month, Blake had already captured several Dutch ships as they passed through the narrow sea. Instead, the VOC convoy intended to sail north and east, around the Irish and Scottish coasts, pass through the Shetland Isles, and safely home. But they were spotted, and word was soon sent to Blake, headquartered at the Downs. His orders were clear. The priority was the VOC fleet, and so Blake sailed north, with almost all his ships. Now, you might have noticed a gap in this strategy. What about Tromp and the massive Dutch navy that was a short hop, skip and a jump across the Channel? Was it wise to leave the south and east coasts of England relatively unprotected? This seems to have occurred to the Council of State too, although not in their initial orders to Blake, because after Blake set sail, a letter from the Council arrived at Dover, asking what was he planning to do about Tromp. But Blake had not left the Channel completely defenceless. George Askew, recently returned from the Caribbean, had been left to guard the Channel with about 9 ships. He seems to have been confident in his position. When he learned that a Dutch convoy of between 30 and 40 merchant ships, with their escort of 4 warships, was sailing towards him, he did not hesitate. Askew's small fleet easily captured 6 of them, another 26 ran aground near Calais, and the rest managed to escape. Then there was a race between the English and the French, because the French wanted to make the most of this windfall which had just fallen into their lap, and the English were determined to destroy it. Cue scenes of French soldiers hacking through the hulls of beached ships with axes, looting as much cargo as they could, all while cannonballs from the English ship rained down on them. The day after this skirmish, Tromp received his orders from the States General. Since the wind wouldn't allow him to pursue Blake north, he was instead told to find and defeat Ayscue's small fleet, which was sheltering in the Downs. The Downs sit between Dover and the entrance to the Thames, and is a natural resting place for ships. Tromp knew it well, not only because he'd sheltered there himself, but because it was in the Battle of the Downs that he had famously destroyed a Spanish fleet, all while the Royal Navy, including the Sovereign of the Seas, had watched on powerlessly. Tromp was determined to win a second Battle of the Downs. He sent the Vice-Admiral of Holland and the Vice-Admiral of the North Quarter to take position at the southern approach to the Downs, while he led the rest of his fleet to enter from the north. This would trap the small English fleet, 20 ships in total, and they would be destroyed by 90 Dutch ships. Ayscue prepared as best as he could for the coming fight. He brought his ships close to shore and ordered artillery to be set up on the coast. Combined with the fire from a nearby castle, it might help even the odds. But even so, it did not look good for the English. But then the weather changed. As Tromp's fleet prepared to enter the Downs and engage the English, the wind dropped, and everyone was becalmed. When the wind picked back up, it was now coming from the south, and so Tromp switched course. Ayscue was a distraction, something to occupy his fleet until he could pursue Blake. With the new southerly wind, he could race after the main English fleet, and so he did so. Ayscue watched, probably relieved, as the massive Dutch fleet weighed anchor and sailed north. This had been the assumption at the heart of Blake's strategy. Apart from Blake's orders, which had been pretty clear in prioritising the VOC fleet, it seems that both Blake and Ayscue were convinced that Tromp could not just sit around the channel while Dutch merchant shipping was picked off everywhere else. He would have to chase Blake, or else face the wrath of angry merchants. And so chase him he did. Blake, meanwhile, had also benefited from the change in wind, and by the 12th of July he had made his planned rendezvous at the Shetland Isles. While awaiting the arrival of their main target, the VOC convoy, Blake sent William Penn on board the Speaker, along with 6 frigates, to find and destroy the escorts of the Dutch Herring Fleet. Penn quickly found his prey, and after a 3-hour battle, most of the escorts had either surrendered, been captured, or, only a few, managed to escape. 3 escorts were scuttled, 2 badly damaged to be of any use. 3 were sent to Inverness to be repaired, and brought into English service, and the rest were immediately added to the fleet. 900 Dutch sailors were taken prisoner, and if that sounds like a lot, it was. Blake was surprised too, and he sent word to Penn to be careful not to risk his ships to a prisoner riot. With the escorts defeated, the question was now, what to do about the fishing fleet? There were more than 600 boats plying Commonwealth waters, and Blake's orders were to destroy this threat to English sovereignty. But whatever the Council of State's orders, Blake didn't see threats to English sovereignty. He just saw terrified fishermen trying to earn their livelihood. Even though many of the boats had fled while the escorts bought them time, many more had not, and Blake would not order the killing, the murder, of thousands of civilians, even if they were guilty of stealing happy British fish. He also didn't have space for thousands more prisoners, and so his standing orders were for the fishermen to be allowed to leave unmolested. He met with one of the fishing captains, who came from the same town which Blake had lived in for a few years as a young man, and the two men had a nice chat about the place, and the captain gave Blake a gift of herring. The fishing fleet departed, and Blake watched the horizon for the sails of the VOC convoy. Meanwhile, Tromp's massive fleet sailed up the English and then Scottish coasts, racing to intercept Blake before Blake could intercept the convoy. Onlookers marvelled at the Dutch ships, but though it was intimidatingly large, the fleet was not as powerful as it first appeared. The main issue was that the ships were undermanned and undersupplied. The beer ration was cut, the food ration was rationed further, and also just terrible, and every other man had scurvy. Now, if you're wondering why the fleet was undermanned when I just said that one of the great advantages that the Dutch had over the English was their manpower, we can blame politics. Trump was a staunch orangist. The States General was dominated by statists. So when Trump received his orders to pursue Blake and protect the VOC fleet, he was also forbidden from returning to port for supplies, repairs, and reinforcements. Instead, he was told to just get going and make do with supplies sent by ship, with all the difficulties that would entail, and to make his repairs at sea. Trump was so undermanned that he resorted to capturing passing English fishing boats and impressing the sailors into his fleet. And not only were these conscripts understandably reluctant to serve, but they also needed feeding, and so the rations got even thinner. And all those fishermen who managed to escape, well, they knew their stuff. The landlubbers watching from the cliffs might have been impressed, but the sailors knew their stuff, and they saw the cracks. One captain who boarded the Brederode to appeal to Trump to release his crew would report that the ships were undermanned and carried much less firepower than the state's navy ships. The two fleets finally caught sight of each other at the remote Shetland island of Fair Isle, and it was not by chance. Both admirals knew the mind of the other. Blake decided that the VOC convoy would probably sail to Fair Isle and wait there for Trump to arrive and escort them home. Trump understood that Blake would come to that conclusion, and so sailed for Fair Isle. Both admirals were correct in their calculations. Both fleets were closing with each other on the 25th of July when the weather once again intervened. The wind disappeared, and a summer fog came down onto the sea. For most of the day, Trump's fleet bobbed in the waves. When the wind finally picked up again, dispersing the fog and revealing in the distance the sails of Blake's ships, the sun was about to set. There'd be no battle that day, and everyone prepared for a fight the next morning. When the sun rose, Trump was surprised with some good news. The VOC convoy had arrived, and it had sailed blindly into the Dutch fleet. The good news was short-lived, though, as the weather once again turned. A fierce gale picked up, and the waves became dangerous as a summer storm battered the North Sea. The fleet scattered. Trump saw one of the Dutch ships enveloped by the waves and sink, and then another. Some crew were rescued, but the rest were lost. Two of the newly arrived merchantmen were smashed against the rocks of the Shetland Isles. When the storm broke on the following day, Trump looked out at his fleet, or what was left of it. The previous morning, he would have seen the sails of nearly 100 vessels, both from his own fleet and from the arrived VOC merchantmen. Now he just saw 34. Among his original fleet had been some fireships, small, low-quality ships that were set alight and aimed at the heart of an enemy formation. They could be quite effective, but they had struggled with the voyage north. None of them survived the storm. But more damaging were the losses from the convoy and from Trump's fighting ships. Now, this wasn't a complete disaster. Most of the missing ships were now somewhere else in the North Sea and not at the bottom of it. Some had found shelter in a Shetland fjord. Others watched the sunrise from Norwegian waters. These ships would make their way back to the Netherlands, but their fate was, at the moment, unknown. Trump spent the next 2 days collecting those ships he could find and making what repairs he could, and then he called a council of war. The captains all agreed that they had to head home. They were in no state to fight, and at least some of the VOC merchantmen could now be escorted back. Trump, frustrated that the weather had prevented a pitched battle, which he believed he would have won, sailed home. On the English side, Blake was also disappointed that there was no battle, because he knew he was in a much better position than Trump. Even before the storm, the state's navy fleet was well supplied, and when the storm came, they'd been able to shelter between Shetland and Bressy Island. He made the repairs he could, and then chased after Trump, but the Dutch ships managed to make it home before he could catch them. Trump limped south and soon reached the Netherlands. Here, his enemies struck. Never mind that Trump had been sent out undermanned and undersupplied, and that the weather had repeatedly stopped him from acting, the disaster was a perfect opportunity to get rid of the Orangist admiral. As stragglers from the storm made their way back, each ship damaged, half their crews injured or down with scurvy, the statists moved against him. Trump jumped before he was pushed. He resigned, and then spent some time writing and publishing a defence of his actions, which I've drawn from before. His enemies had succeeded in removing the influential Orangist, but it had cost the United Provinces one of their greatest naval commanders. In his place as the leader of the navy was Vice Admiral Michiel de Ruyter, but this is not the end of Tromp. Thank you to my House of Lords, the King's favourite Mike Sanders, the Duchess of Devon, Michelle Gersich, the Marquess of Montague, Brandon Stansbury, and the Earl of Hampshire, Keith Dixon. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to join their ranks and listen to the podcast without ads. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or recommend it to a friend. For the other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, such as The Age of Napoleon, check out airwavemedia.com. Thank you to Sounds Like an Earful for the interval music in today's episode, to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.